So tonight's talk is called, What's a Good Question? Thoughts and emotions are going to keep happening as long as this body is living. Along with these thoughts and emotions, at times, unpleasant feeling is going to keep happening as long as this body's living. Realizing or awakening to true nature doesn't remove or eliminate thoughts and emotions. It doesn't eliminate anything. Except ignorance. There are really just two places where humans live. One is conditioned by ignorance, and the other is free of ignorance. And then you could say there's sort of like, because there's a gray in between the black and the white, you could say there's gradations of ignorance and gradations of free from ignorance. Where would you put yourself on that spectrum right now? Or at any moment? Back to our first night, you may recall I spoke about freedom from as contrasted to freedom amidst. And by the way, part of tonight's talk is going to be a little bit of a review and tying together a few things from previous days, and then we'll see what comes after that. It's not going to be an extensive an in-depth review, just going to really kind of hit some of the highlights. Free of ignorance actually means freedom amidst everything. What keeps humans from, or what appears to keep humans from, very important there, what appears to keep humans from the freedom amidst everything is ignorance. You might have gotten a sense by now that the game, and this is a game, it's a game. Life's a game. The name of the game, in a sense, is to figure out how to not get caught. It's a little bit like hide and go seek. I'm going to hide, and something's going to chase me. And I'm going to try to not get found. But I'm probably going to get found. I'm going to get tracked down. I went to that really special spot. I remember mine. Under the sofa. Because I was small enough to get under there. And the bigger siblings probably would not think to look there. But the dearest of the dear sisters knew where to go. And the ankle was the best thing to grab. I got even. Just a quick aside, and I'll get on the point. She, in my view, was a blabbermouth, always blabbing. Some of you were around eating food in the 60s, and some of you might not have been. You didn't miss a lot. But at any rate, there were these green peas, the canned green peas. It's a color green that is sickening.
Jolly green jelly.
There it is. And the green peas came out often. One day, I'd had enough. The infamous older sister was blabbing once again. And I took one of those green peas and I got it right in the center of my palm and I lined it up. And I waited for the moment when it looked like I was not being watched. And I launched. This was the first moment of awakening for little Paul, because the pea went right in her mouth. I'm skipping that part for now. Let's see if it comes back. Game is to not get caught. Or, to put it another way, the only thing that keeps life, you, from living freely amidst everything is ignorance. And what ignorance? Ignorance of true nature. So what happens then if you're in the game, and it's a good idea to be in the game if you're here, it's a good idea to be playing the game if you're here, and it'd be okay, perhaps, to play it fully. Fully in the game. Not spectating. I'm in the game. I'm playing. How to not get caught? So what happens is, you get very interested in where you get caught. Because you see clearly that you can't get uncaught unless you see where you get caught. When I don't know who I am, what I am, I'm actually bereft. I'm lost. I'm adrift. I'm perpetually wandering. Others might think I know what I'm doing, and you know, I'm walking now, and I'm going to the dining hall, and the arms are, you know, into the meditation as well. There's not too many of these types on this retreat, but every now and then you got an occasional, you know, slow walker in front of you there, you know, just taking their time, going into the dining hall, and the arms are moving just a little bit too, just for extra credit. I keep the arms going. Doesn't happen very often. Can't name names here. This is confidential. There's nothing wrong with the wandering. It's part of the game. Nothing wrong with it. But it's unsatisfactory. And within that unsatisfactory wandering, as I mentioned previous nights, there's often an incessant, subtle, or not so subtle, longing for home. Longing for completion. Longing for okayness. Longing for rest. Plug it in. Longing for dot, dot, dot. Longing to get the window blind up. Longing to hear that sound end. Longing. Dot, dot, dot. Once the sense of separation has appeared, then there's the bewilderment, relative lostness, and be because there's the lostness, there's the seeking for home. There's the seeking to reunite. And as we can see, that longing, that seeking takes, oh, so many different forms. From material acquisitions to relationships, to places, to things, to meditative states, to conceptions of freedom, Buddha nature, enlightenment, on and on and on and on it goes. It's all about finding out what or who you really are, which is the same thing as free of suffering. Finding out who, what you really are is synonymous with free of suffering. Now, I mentioned some things about this clinging last night. So let's take the three areas where the mind clings. Again, very clear from the Buddha. Three things that are clung onto. One, sense pleasures. Believe it or not, a lot of humans engage in a lot of sense pleasure happiness because it's the easiest one to get if you can get it. And then there's clinging to it, wanting to repeat it, go back, do it again, change it, have it a little different here, a little different there, a little better. The other kind of clinging is to a sense of existence. I exist, and I want to continue to exist. So there's a clinging to a sense of existing. And then the third, very interesting, clinging to a sense of I don't want to exist. When a human being goes into the suicidal ideation, or the suicidal intention, or the suicidal plan, or the suicidal act, there's clinging to a notion of, don't know what I'm doing, but it's a notion of non-existence. I want to not exist. I might be trying to end some sense of suffering. Clinging. I don't know whether you like this question or not, but I'll go ahead and I'll say I think it's a good question. Since the title of the talk is What's a Good Question, I might as well ask one. Why did the separation occur? Why? Not how, not when, not to whom, why? Some people don't like why, but I'm going to ask why right now. Why did the separation occur? And I would say, because sometimes when you ask your own question, you can go ahead and take a shot at the answer. I would say there was a no more terse and direct answer then simply for the purpose of awakening from it. And if you've got a better answer, let me know before we park tomorrow. Or email me. And I'm pretty sure that if you Google that question, you might not get much. But I don't know that for a fact. The whole teaching is about recognizing your true nature, home, Buddha nature, freedom, what you really are. Now, funny little thing is, we already are that we're looking for. So the whole game is this thing called awakening. We already are what we're looking for. But there's degrees of awakening or awakenedness within that. Because I think it's pretty clear, hopefully everybody here, that your Buddha nature is not going to arise as a realization by trying to get something out there, but funny thing also is it's not going to arise or awaken by trying to get something in here. Keeps the game interesting. What good is a game if it isn't interesting? Parcheesi got dull. Parcheesi, Parcheesi, Parcheesi. Parcheesi. Oh, Parcheesi. I just wanted to shake those dice and then just let them fly right out of the cup. Parcheesi. Green peas and Parcheesi. As authentic opening happens, there's different kinds of openings, but this opening I'm referring to, this opening includes everything. It's not just an expansion, you know, like this chest feels smooth and tingly and now my heart's open. You know what an open heart is? It's the space of awareness that allows and includes and doesn't interfere with any emotion or feeling. Just to name one part of the open heart. If you think about that, expanded, full breathing, tingling, and warm sensation towards Steve or Laura, Bill. That's the open heart. And then I'm sitting here, and this thing's just going like this. It's going like this. It's going like this. This isn't an open heart. You know what that is? That's a judgment. This is an open heart. My heart's closed. You know how popular it is to say, closed, open, closed, open. I'm open, I'm closed. And I like open better. And I like you when you're open. I don't like you as much when you're closed. So open up. Okay, we send it right out there. Open, closed, open, closed. Big preference. I'm talking about authentic opening. When authentic opening is happening, all experiences are allowed and not interfered with. Thoughts, emotions, sensations, and an increasing sense that they're not inhibited. That's the meditative awareness, non-interfering. And things can then move more and more freely. And what happens is you get a little bonus prize. In case you still don't like certain experiences, when there's openness that they're arising within, they change more quickly. Hey, I got what I wanted. Hey, the pain went away quicker. Woohoo! It's like the brakes come off. You get this sense like you've had your foot on the brake. You ever ride with somebody who's got a foot on the gas and a foot on the brake at the same time? They do exist. Okay? My dear father-in-law was one of them. He pumped the pedal of that Scirocco. It was a 16-valve black, you know, sporty car because he liked those sporty cars. Vroom, vroom. He'd go like that going down the highway with his foot on the brake at the same time. Didn't dare say anything to him. There's people that you don't say certain things to. Play it safe in this game. Don't say certain things to certain people. Hey, Dad, do you think we'd get there a little smoother or easier if you did two different things, like took your foot off the brake and stopped going like that? Where are we? Dharma is supposed to give you a sense of a greater meaning, but sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes things just float out there, and it's like, that doesn't make any sense. All right, that's got to be okay too, I guess. The filtering effect of interfering comes off, and what remains is a very direct and immediate intimacy. An immediacy and an intimacy. And this intimacy, watch these words from Zen Master Dogen, 12th century Zen master, one of the greatest. Enlightenment is the intimacy of all things. enlightenment is the intimacy of all things. As the conceptualizing brain-mind hears words about true nature, it often easily makes associations, as it's been doing since it was born. Makes associations to almost everything, because that's how it works. It'll make up interpretations of true nature. True nature is like the open sky. Or true nature is silence. True nature is like space. True nature is freedom from suffering. Or wait a minute, freedom of suffering. Freedom amidst suffering. That's it. Freedom is true nature. True nature is somewhere other than where I am. I don't know what true nature is. It'll make it up. These are all just words. See if you can sense the difference between those words and these. Invitation, no imposition, would be, if you'd like, you may close your eyes for this. No need to get deeply meditative, but just let the eyes gently close. This is again from Dogen. It is entitled On the Treasury of the True Dharma Eye. Watch what spontaneously moves. Midnight. No waves. No wind. The empty boat is flooded with moonlight. Trying to figure out how to get something or to not have something as a means of realizing true nature is ignorance in action. Specifically mobilized as escapism. In fact, if we look closely, trying to not have anything once it's already happening, or trying to have anything that is currently not happening, is an expression of unsatisfactoriness. These activities I just named are abstractions, dreams about a life I prefer to have. What we are exploring is the possibility of coming out of abstracted imaginations about life. And it might be interesting to note together that much of the inner work that humans engage in is actually ending up, when it works, strengthening a sense of self-identity or self-fixation rooted in time, purpose, and goals. Now I'm getting myself together. I'm getting on time. My purpose is clearer, and I've identified my goals. If you believe you are in singular, a body, self, something existing in time, then purpose and goals make perfect sense. However, when you look deeply at these repetitive cycles, and they are, of achieving, acquiring, obtaining, maintaining, and of course losing. Something profoundly fundamental is often overlooked. As the mind might be seeking true nature, or in fact, seeking anything, the treasure that we seek is to be discovered not in where we are going, but within the simple nature of the very footsteps we take, the very breath the body breathes, the very sounds that are arising. As the meditative awareness operates more and more completely and deeply, at first, as it becomes clear what the meditative awareness is, it seems that true nature is only in the light of awareness. It's the awareness itself. That seems to be the only thing here. If there's any lucidity, any stillness, any openness, any presence, it's that awareness. Not in the cycles of experience. It's the awareness. And so we begin to think true nature is not in experiences that are coming and going, that are changing all the time. True nature is not, in fact, where all this transitoriness is occurring. It's in the awareness. This is extremely compelling. It's extremely attractive. You might have even thought I said it. When you're sitting and you're actually sensing, I'm beyond the pull of the thoughts and the emotions and the I'm actually resting beyond it. This is true nature here. Here we are. And if any of that's happened, you probably noticed it changed. But still, the belief, the thought might have been there. There it is. I got it. Lest we forget, this is all just descriptions. Even Dogen's poignant, succinct poem, words. Thoughts about true nature. You might have had a few thoughts in the last few days. You might have had so many thoughts, you can't even count how many you had in one sitting. You can't even count how many you had in 5 minutes. You can't figure out how many you had in a minute. Here's a thought. Actually, it's a question. How come vegan brownies are almost always a little or a lot too dry? I want to know the answer to that. That's good. My whole job here is to get one of you to fall off your seat. That's good. You want those adjustable types so that when the no self starts to dissolve, the cushion, the bench goes sideways. Anyway, somebody can give me the answer to that vegan brownie thing. How about this one? I don't know what an insight is yet, but I sure know how to meditate on people's feet. I know how to do that. Or a more serious one, maybe. Who gets to experience the no self after the self that never was is gone? And if it is nobody, I want to meet him. So the thoughts are not continuous. They're not. There are gaps between the thoughts. And as we become less fixated on the thoughts, and all those thoughts seem to be saying about things, because they've got thoughts about thoughts about thoughts about thoughts about thoughts about thoughts. Proliferation of thoughts. I once heard these described in meditation as discursive thinking. And I thought, what's the difference between discursive thinking and non-discursive thinking? And I sat around trying to figure that out. And I realized as I was trying to figure that out, I was having a lot of discursive thoughts. That's when the insight came. Oh, this is discursive thinking. I'm trying to figure this out. Gaps between the thoughts start to appear. Little spots, little spaces. Little ones. The true nature is also simple nature. And the space between the thoughts is the same as the space before and after the thoughts. One space. Showing up in different spots. And it's so simple. And as we recognize this more and more, it can be startling. I mean startling. To realize not only how wonderful that space, that gap is, but how much it's overlooked. And out of this, dare I say, wonder of simplicity, comes a deeper appreciation, ever deepening, I'd say, for the true nature of the natural world. The more the silent space between the thoughts appears, the more it's recognized that there's a love and a gratitude that's almost coming right off of those trees and the river and the grass and the sky and the moon and the sun. Or at least at times it's coming from this towards that. It's amazing and wonderful at the same time. I've been quoting too many guys on this retreat. It's time for a woman. Guys, just between you and me, women, you can listen. Guys, we wouldn't be here without you women. Now you know, and I'm not going to explain now, that I'm a feminist in drag. Don't ask me about that, unless you have a really good question, because I'm not answering. It's a serious koan. This is from Azumi. Azumi was a court lady, I guess means she worked in the courts, and she is considered one of Japan's greatest poets. Lived from 974 to 1034. Again, watching the moon at dawn, solitary, mid-sky, I knew myself completely, no part left out. The nature of wisdom born from insight, which is this recognizing I'm talking about, is not to be found through thinking about things, but rather it's the space between the thoughts that allows wisdom to flower in the form of insight. That's why there's a fundamental difference between wisdom and knowledge. Knowledge, as I'm speaking of it, is acquired information. It's things that you learn, it's things that you conceptually understand, it's things that you remember. and you could recite or you could talk about. He's very knowledgeable about this or that. Wisdom is very different. Although they, as I've been saying here in the game, you know, they can touch and interface quite a bit. Wisdom is insight born from direct realization, direct insight. Insights come out of the silence. The true nature can never be figured out. It can only be realized. And as it's realized that everything belongs to nature. Everything belongs to nature. Including the idea of me belongs to nature. Meditative awareness reveals this. Meditative awareness illuminates this. It illuminates that there's actually no experiencer inside the awareness that has the awareness or that makes the awareness work. That is the awareness. There is no experiencer in there. Recognizing that there's no experiencer inside awareness is the same as the second kind of emptiness that I spoke of last night, which is the emptiness of no clinging. As soon as it's clear that there's no experiencer inside awareness, experiencing awareness or other things, it's the same as the second kind of emptiness, which is the emptiness of no clinging. Open, free awareness of no clinging. Truth can only be fully comprehended through insight. That is one of the rules of the game. Awareness simply is, and in its isness, it's simply being. And it is, in fact, what abides in the gaps between thoughts, as well as that which sees the thoughts. This can and does open more and more clearly. Again, straight shot from the master of the game. Guess who? Your dear buddy, I hope by now, and certainly mine, you can tell, I think, the Buddha, taught birth is perpetual suffering. Birth is perpetual suffering. What often arises when these words are heard in the mind, conceptual brain mind, is, okay, so then the whole point of freedom is to not be born? Because I want freedom, and if birth is perpetual suffering, then I guess the idea is to not be born. That's a problem, because I am born. I think, to myself or others. Therefore, what am I supposed to do? Watch this one. The mind will go, I'll die and not be born again. That's off the board somewhere. Like, I don't know about that. That's kind of, sounds like a whole nother game. Imagination. Let's examine what the Buddha meant by birth. He's not referring to birth of the body-mind process. Believe it or not, this is in fact a perfect manifestation of true nature, no less than a flower, the open blue sky, the moon in a dewdrop, or the open nature of awareness. He's not referring to the birth of thoughts, feelings, perceptions, consciousness. But the sense of I was born, I am born, this seems so true. Seems so correct. I am born. Yeah. I was born. The I am thought. That's what he meant by birth. I am. And it's very easy, isn't it? Quite habitual to fill in the blank after the words I am. I am. Off it goes. This and that and this and that and this and that and this and that. All boiled round to, in most cases, body, feeling, perception, thought activity, consciousness. Five aggregates. Most people will not say, they will not say, I am my car. Every now and then you get somebody who goes that far. I am my house. I love my house so much I am it. Most people just stick right to the body, to the feelings, to the perception, to the thought activity, and to the so-called consciousness. This is what birth means. The birth of the I am. I am. The I am is a thought, and birth means it has arisen. Rebirth means it has arisen again after it died. You can't have rebirth without death, can you? So the I's got to die to then be reborn. Same I, different I? Same guy? Same gal? He was referring to the birth of the mistaken idea or false identity of I, which turns into me and mine. He's not referring to physical birth, as it's generally supposed. Birth also refers to attachment unaccompanied by awareness. It's not that attachment is bad, it should not be happening. It's not that clinging and grasping are bad and should not be happening. It's that attaching, clinging, and grasping can only arise when the I has arisen. Birth is perpetual suffering. Now watch the second half of the teaching. Birth is perpetual suffering, he supposedly said. True happiness consists of the elimination of the false idea or view of I. This is the whole teaching, not just the Buddha's. Right here. Hear it in different words. In this world, but not of it. Thy will, not mine. All aim at the liberation from self-centeredness. When that self-centeredness gets going strong enough, it's selfishness. Most people find selfishness quite despicable, except the one who's selfish. I love it. More subtle is self-consciousness. Ah, self-consciousness. The beautiful arising of shyness. Because in the game, the only issue that causes problems and stress and trouble is the false idea of I, which, as I mentioned before, can never actually be tracked down and found to exist. Can't find it, no one can. Actually go on that part of the game and look for it is not always that easy to do. Ramana Maharshi called it self-inquiry. Who am I? Not a very easy practice for some folks. But it works in some cases. False idea of I. Which, when it's not seen clearly, quickly, rapidly moves into identifying with forms of experience and owning objects. And then the whole dance of duality stems right from there. I am the subject. Everything else are the objects. And these, at least some of these, are mine. So this is what it means. When I say abiding as awareness, slowly but surely, and sometimes in cases suddenly, reveals there is no I, and in that instant there's momentary nirvana. Nirvana means extinction of suffering. It's one of its definitions. Heat or anxiety, extinction of suffering, heat or anxiety. Therefore, it is considered as coolness or peace. Hot objects, when they've cooled, are said to have nirvanad. Animals that have been tamed or rendered docile or harmless are said to have been nirvanad. How does a human realize nirvana? Can never be figured out. Thought can never reach it. It can only be realized. And when it's realized, it's seen that I am not existing, but rather existence is blossoming in awareness. I am not existing, but rather existing is blossoming in awareness. Now, I wasn't going to do this. But usually when I have a thought to do something, and then I have a counter thought to not do it, I always end up doing it. I don't have time to go into the consequences of that particular part of the talk. If you have a question, I'm open later. Or you can tell me about your escapades. This is a sutra. This is a sutra, this is a sermon about a monk Anuruddha was asked by some other monks a very difficult question. The question that they asked him was, does the Buddha exist after his death? Anuruddha responded, the Buddha is not spoken of in these ways. The group of monks began to laugh at him, probably thinking, that's completely insufficient. So he went to the Buddha and they had a conversation. Listen carefully with everything except your brain, which is kind of impossible, but I can at least ask for it. You get the setup, right? He's asked a question, he gives an insufficient answer, they make fun of him, and so laugh at him, so he goes to the Buddha. This is the conversation. Oh, by the way, he tells the Buddha what happened. So he gives him an insight on what went down, and then the Buddha says, oh, Anuruddha, what do you think is the form, it's called rupa in Pali, rupa, is the form permanent or impermanent? Easy answer, right? Impermanent, sir. Is that which is impermanent painful or pleasant? Painful, sir. Is it proper to regard that which is impermanent, painful, and subject to change as this is mine, this is I, this is my soul, or permanent substance? It is not proper, sir. Is feeling permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, sir. Is that which is impermanent, painful, or pleasant? Painful, sir. Is it proper to regard that which is impermanent, painful, and subject to change as this is mine, this is I, this is my soul? It is not proper, sir. Are perceptions, formative tendencies, that's mental formations, and consciousness, permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, sir. He's got 100 on the test so far. Is that which is impermanent painful or pleasant? Painful, sir. Is it proper to regard that which is impermanent, painful, and subject to change as this is mine, this is I, this is my soul? It is not proper, sir. Still got 100. Now watch. Therefore, whatever form, feeling, perception, formative tendency, consciousness, which have been, will be, and is now connected with myself or with others, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, all forms, feelings, perceptions, formative tendencies, and consciousness should be considered by right knowledge in this way. This is not mine. This is not I. This is not my soul. You can see he clearly confirms Anuruddha's answers. Now, this is where it gets a little trickier. Maybe, maybe not. I must pause and let you know the word Tathagata is now going to be used. Tathagata means the Buddha, or better translated as one thus gone. One thus gone. Remember, the question is, does the Buddha exist after his death? What do you think, Anuruddha? Do you regard the form as the Tathagata? Do you regard the form as the Buddha? No, sir. O Anuruddha, what is your view? Do you see a Tathagata in the form? No, sir. Do you see a Tathagata apart from form? No, sir. Do you see a Tathagata in feeling, perception, mental formation, consciousness? No, sir. O Anuruddha, what do you think? Do you regard that which is without form, feeling, perception, formative tendencies, and consciousness as the Tathagata? No, sir. Tricky right here. Now, Anuruddha, since a Tathagata is not to be found in this very life, is it proper for you to say a Tathagata exists after death? No, sir. A Tathagata does not exist after death. No, sir. A Tathagata exists and yet does not exist after death. No, sir. A Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist after death. No, sir. Well and good, Anuruddha. Formally now. And always, I expound and point out only the truth of suffering and cessation of suffering. If you're feeling a little bit of there's nowhere to go, you're getting the answer. Perhaps a little easier than that one. Back it off just a smudge. Ordinary beings are the Buddha. This is Hung Po. Hung Po was 7 feet tall. I love this guy. 7 feet tall, had a pearl-shaped lump in the middle of his forehead. I love that too. I don't know why. I just like it. Ordinary beings are the Buddha, he says, just as they are. The Buddha is one with them. Both have the same nature. The phenomenal universe and nirvana, activity and stillness, all have the same nature. So do all possible worlds and the state that transcends all worlds. The beings that pass through the 6 stages of existence, those who've undergone the 4 kinds of birth, all the worlds with their vast mountains and rivers, enlightenment and delusion, all of them are the same. When I say they're the same, they all have the same nature. I mean that their names and forms, their existence and non-existence, are empty. The vast world systems, uncountable as the sands of the Ganges, are all contained in the one boundless, empty, radiant mind. How then can there be Buddhas who save or ordinary beings who must be saved? If the true nature of all things is the same, how can such distinctions be real? If it was up to me, I would entitle that piece of writing The Home Run by Hung Po. Can we sit for a minute or two?